spell out the principal influences on the most authoritative and comprehensive dictionary of English in the world, as Oxford University Press rightfully describes it, is to gain some insight into the community and culture that has taken hold of the language in the past and for the years ahead. The generations of editors behind this empire of words would be the first to claim that the Oxford English Dictionary is not meant to be the final or redemptive keeper of the word. It is only an extensive instance of what each of us does in attending to the passing meaning of the world.
Educator and author John Wilinski. He'll be back in just a moment with more about his new book, Empire of Words, an account of language, meaning, and the reign of the Oxford English Dictionary. Welcome to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Partial support for Soundings comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Because of its reach as a force in commerce and culture, the English language exerts enormous political and social power in the modern world. For most students of the language, the chief record of this linguistic power is the Oxford English Dictionary. But where does the OED get its authority, and how does the weight of that authority manifest itself? In a provocative new study, Canadian author and educator John Wilinski explores such questions. His new book is Empire of Words, subtitled The Reign of the OED. This phrase goes to the argument that for many years the Oxford English Dictionary reflected the imperialism of the Victorian world that produced it.
I know, it may seem rather odd. The dictionary seems a tame artifact, something that sits on the shelf and is not part of what we typically think of the empire, of the ships plowing through the sea. But in fact, now that the empire is gone, we have remnants like the dictionary that are there to remind us. That is, the Oxford English Dictionary stands for world English. It stands for a language that exists as an official language all around the world in many nations. And in one sense, then, after the empire has left, we've been left with the sense of world English,
right,
as a ruling domain.
Did it begin that way with a sort of...
No, I think it really began with a sense of that England was at the center of the empire, center of the world as it saw itself in the 19th century, and that it needed a dictionary to support that. It needed a sense of its own history.
Uh-huh.
So along with the National Portrait Gallery, along with the British Museum, there needed to be something that held the glory of the language.
Uh-huh. Give me a sense of the shape of the OED, how it began and how it developed. We go back to what, the 1880s or so?
Even earlier, in the 1850s. I mean, it began as an amateur gentleman's project. It was the Philological Society, a group of men who would meet, and some women, who would meet and discuss aspects of language. Mm-hmm. And they decided that Johnson's dictionary was a wonderful thing, but that its day had passed. It was a century old already, it was an idiosyncratic work, and that they needed a national dictionary, one that was exhaustive, authoritative, and that, as it were, would back this great empire that was being built.
And you had a schoolmaster who stepped into this process.
Well, not in the first instance. We had a Reverend Trench,
uh-huh,
a minister of the church, who believed that words were a moral as well as national source of authority.
Mm-hmm.
And through his interest, that's through Reverend Trench's interest, the whole project began. He did a critique of all of the existing dictionaries. He inspired the Philological Society, and the project was undertaken.
Uh-huh.
Then comes our schoolmaster, James Murray.
All right. This is the man who was, what's the title of the book about him? He was caught in the web of words.
That's right.
Okay.
Yes.
Tell me
and
about Murray.
A charming fellow. I mean, a schoolmaster who, in fact, continued to teach school even after he took on the project.
Uh-huh.
He was interested as an amateur in language. And was very concerned with developments of Scottish dialects, for example, got caught up in the Philological Society, saw that the project, the dictionary itself, was floundering,
mm-hmm,
and took it over and built in his backyard a scriptorium. He called his students in to help him. His family were engaged in sorting and citing language for the dictionary. It was a project that consumed his life and a project that became the center of his existence.
Mm-hmm.
In his backyard, he has a tin shed that he's had to sink into the ground because it blocked the view of his neighbor. And in this damp tin shed, he has gathered citations from all over England, Europe, Canada, North America. And he's begun to arrange them in alphabetical order and to assemble the whole corpus of the English language.
And a project that began with a timetable of, what was it, a half a dozen years, maybe 10 years?
Three volumes, very modest work. Yeah. And it was 70 years. Poor Murray died working on the letter T, didn't see it completed. But he was so convinced that he needed to needed to create this dictionary that was thorough. The original plan was to include every word in the language, but of course that was totally unrealistic, and Murray was, if anything, was a realist. And he took it onto himself to decide what it was that would go in to create a very reasonable scope of the language, but he was overwhelmed.
So we begin in the 1850s, we move to the beginning of the beginning in the 1880s, and then we move, what, into the 1920s?
Before it's completed, about 1928, when the final volume comes out.
And what happens after the 1920s to bring us another 70 years into the future?
Well, in fact, there's a kind of exhaustion that overcomes the dictionary side of Oxford University Press, and things shut down. And they're revived again in the 50s with Robert Birchfield, who takes on the supplement. So, I mean, as it was, the letter A came out 50-odd years before the letter Z. So there was already a datedness to the dictionary, and its final volume includes an addendum, makes up some of the difference. So the dictionary is always in this dated sense, always, oddly enough, with the letter A behind the earlier letters, far behind the later ones. So Birchfield in the 50s takes on the job of doing a supplement, of updating the dictionary. And his responsibility is the 20th century, and we begin to get a very different dictionary, where the original Victorian version was built by amateurs. Birchfield begins to call on scholars and professionals.
All right, now we're going to unpack some of those issues, John, as we talk about empire of words. Tell me parenthetically and quickly, is the dictionary, is the OED making money now for Oxford University Press? It started out exactly the opposite.
It was totally a drain. It went way over budget. It was an act of faith on the part of Oxford University Press, which wasn't the original publisher. They had been dropped by two or three by then. It decided to take it on, and I have a theory about the Bible's role in that, because Oxford University Press was a publisher of the Bible, and there's some reason to think that sales were declining by the end of the 19th century. And here was something that might offer another opportunity, a different kind of Bible in terms of the English language.
Well, didn't you tell me that you initially thought about calling your book the Book of Books, and then decided that that might not fly?
There was a lot of controversy about that. I mean, it is literally a book of books in terms of its citation, in terms of the way it cites the books of the English language. And it has this biblical analogy in terms of its authority, but there is a difference.
Tell me, John, about the origins of meaning. Here we're into some heavy-duty language. The meaning of meaning, and what does the OED have to do with that?
The OED takes a stance, and really this comes from Samuel Johnson. That is, how do we pin down how words mean? And the decision that Johnson made, and he certainly wasn't the first, but he was in terms of the English language dictionaries, decided that the best source of authority, the source of meaning for us, were published authors. And that we could count on the way the authors used the language because those were being circulated through their books, and that they had some great insight, some great care and affection for the language. So the Oxford English Dictionary took up that theme, although it didn't do it in the same way that Johnson did, as a kind of my favorites, but tried to be much more exhaustive and comprehensive.
Well, already we've got a couple of problems. That is to say, a limited number of sources that you're looking at. You're assuming a sort of literacy on the part of the maker and the consumer of the dictionary. You've got more exclusion than you've got inclusion, even though you've got the so-called great writers at work.
Well, there are many aspects.
That's part of your argument.
That's right. There are many aspects to that, because in some sense, the oral language comes first, and we all believe in the orality as sort of the original or the authentic aspect of language, and writing is a kind of secondary process. But for the dictionary, the writing becomes the source, becomes the origin and I mean, it is the place of meaning.
Who are the most frequently cited authors in those original incarnations of the Oxford English Dictionary?
Well, I think the audience would have guessed even by the time you finish the question. I mean, I think it has a literary bias, and that puts Shakespeare at the very top. And Shakespeare outdoes Scott, who comes second, Sir Walter Scott comes second, by a 2-to-1 ratio.
Now, this is Scott as the author that Mark Twain said has done more damage to literature and the language than anybody else. And yet he's one of the most frequently cited.
He's one of the most popular, and certainly was in his day, when this dictionary was coming about. And Scott is interesting, too, because, although we should probably spend more time on Shakespeare, but Scott's interest is as a historian of language. That is, Scott's historical novels go back and try to recapture the language. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's an odd way of creating a dictionary based on documentation, because Scott is not an authentic source. Scott himself is fictionalizing and creating a sense of the language as something from the past that he's bringing forward.
All right. Now, the editors of the OED would look at writers like Scott or Shakespeare, or again, you know, you could tick off the top 20, the Casey Kasem list, and they are using these citations to say this is the way a word is used by a famous writer, and therefore that is what a word means.
But not just one writer.
All right.
I mean, the rule of thumb that they used was they should have one writer from each century.
Uh-huh.
And during the 19th century, one writer from each decade. So in some way, they were trying to distribute the authority, but in the other sense, they were trying to give a history of meaning so that you can go into the Oxford English Dictionary in a way that you can't with other dictionaries, and you can look at each century going back to the 1200s.
All right, now that sounds fairly innocuous, but what does that do to the meaning of meaning? In what ways, I mean, how do you critique process?
In some ways, it unsettles the sense of a single meaning or even a single spelling for a word, because as the word moves through its history, you can see changes.
Mm-hmm.
A good example is the word literature, for example. It originally applied to people. That is, you had literature, you knew letters, you were literate. And then eventually changed in the 19th century into an institution. That is, the works of literature, the body of literature.
Now, what the neoconservatives today would call the great books.
And the canon.
All right, and the canon. Fair enough. Continue.
Well, that sense is one of the interesting aspects. That is, the dictionary allows you to understand that meaning does change.
Uh-huh.
And that meaning is contested in a sense. That is, you can look at different authors using the words differently, even within the same time period, so that the sense is that the language is alive, that the language is developing, and that we're caught in this flow.
Well, what's wrong with looking back to writers like Scott or Shakespeare or Milton and finding the sources of our cultural authority?
Well, Wayne, you've got the other side of the problem. That is, I've just given the positive side, that the meaning is fluid and that there's possibilities of continuing to contribute to it. But the other side is that it's always a selective representation. And that is, Shakespeare, at 35,000 citations, he's in about 14% of the entries,
mm-hmm.
has an undue, some people would say, others would say, a rightful place in the language. And that there are many, many writers who've been excluded and countless numbers of speakers of the language who aren't contributing in the same way that these authors are.
All right. Now, as the inclusiveness as a pattern increases, particularly recently in the history of the Oxford English Dictionary, what is the effect on the meaning of meaning?
Well, let's go back and finish the point about the exclusiveness, and that is the sense of who was left out. I mean,
Fair enough.
Know that the great authors were included, the great English authors in the first instance were included, but the groups that at least in my study, appear to be left out are three in number.
All right. Now, we're about to talk about race and we're about to talk about gender.
Well, not exactly. No, we're about to talk about bureaucrats.
Fair enough.
We're about to talk about class and we're about to talk about gender. The three groups, in fact, are the largest group left out are at least I would argue, are women writers. That is, women were publishing. Women novelists of the 18th century were quite plentiful and available. And although there was already a selective process going on, that is, women weren't being published as frequently and had a much more difficult time, often had to disguise that they were women to be published, their representation in the dictionary is even less than I think is warranted.
Isn't it in the statistics in your book, John, that George Eliot, we have a male name, but we have a female writer, is one of the most, of the women who are included in the OED initially, she's the one who's toward the top of the list.
Yes, she is.
Well, but she's not representative necessarily.
Well, I mean, she's still much less. Her representation is much less than the top men authors.
Uh-huh.
And I think if you think about your favorite women authors, whether it's Jane Austen or the Bronte sisters, you'll see that they did not receive their due in terms of the dictionary. So that's one body that has been left out, and that's one area that's been remedied somewhat in more recent editions of the dictionary.
And who are the others?
The other two are the working class. That is, there was, during the 19th century, there was a revival, not a revival, there was a birth of a working class press. It came out of the Chartist movement. The unions were forming, and it was a time in which there was a great deal of publication by the working class, but it was almost totally disregarded by the Oxford English Dictionary.
What about the argument that the writers who are cited are writing, in fact, about the working class? You want the source itself rather than the big shots writing about the little guys.
Well, especially if you have a dictionary that's claiming to have an authentic hold on the language to be exhaustive. So Charles Dickens gets lots of coverage and gives wonderful expression to the working class in many, many instances, but there's still a difference. And that is, this is not a compendium of great quotations. It is not supposed to be a dictionary of literature and its uses. It's supposed to be the language as she is spoke, is one of the phrases that's often used. And in that sense, they're missing it. But let me get to the third group that's left out, because this is the one that in a sense, surprised me, and that was the bureaucrats. That is, the argument that's made by linguists is that the chancery courts of the 15th and 16th century were a strong source of standard English, that once French had been dropped as the legal language and that the English became the standard, it was the courts and the law that began to have a profound effect on how the language was being written. Well, I mean, still today, the law and the courts are something that influences.
Sure. This is interesting because this is the source that many historians would go to when they're trying to figure out what happened back there. And yet the linguists, the etymologists, the people who tell us the history of the language in the dictionaries weren't going back there.
Well,
that's odd.
The linguists. Now, you have to remember this is a dictionary that's constructed not by linguists.
Uh-huh.
This is a dictionary constructed by amateur readers. This is enthusiastic readers.
Sending in their entries.
Reading Shakespeare. Well, actually, it's interesting. They didn't read Shakespeare because they used the concordance. But sending in their favorite authors, certainly Sir Walter Scott and others. And in a sense, giving their, it was their favorites. And so the bureaucrats and the legal papers and the sorts of records that had come down historically and were available were overlooked. But in terms of their influence on the language, there are good arguments to be made that the law had and the courts had and the parliament and other legal and democratic institutions had a profound influence in the language.
Well, it's another irony here is that I don't know if it's happening so much anymore, but it seems to me that it was a commonplace a few years ago to pick up the sort of current and ongoing histories of language in magazines like Harper's or The Atlantic or The Saturday Review, and to find the examples of bureaucratic language skewered as offensive and debasing and vacuous, empty, all that doublespeak. And you're telling me that we need to go back in time and pay attention to bureaucratic language.
Well, William Safire apart, I mean, there is a sense in which there's an influence. I mean, you think about this point in time and other phrases that have been greatly criticized but have come into our language out of that bureaucratic sensibility.
Pentagonese, that kind of thing?
Absolutely. And the dictionary, again, is not there to judge. I mean, Safire is there to judge, but the dictionary is to record. And I think that its faithfulness to that sense of documentation of the language is what we're most interested in and where the dictionary is vulnerable to criticism on.
Where, when we speak of the Oxford English Dictionary, John Walensky, and your title again, Empire of Words, tell me about the polarities of description and proscription. Where does the OED fall? You're telling me that it's a record. It's not a guide.
No. I think falls unfair, Wayne. I think it stumbles and trips on terms of prescription and description because the commitment was, and this is the age of science, this is the Victorian England, so the aim for the Oxford English Dictionary was to be descriptive. But it's hard to throw off that sensibility of trying to get the language right.
Well, as it becomes a cultural icon and an institution, it automatically takes on a kind of power in our lives, in the lives of our students.
Well, and if it was truly descriptive, if it was absolutely a documentation of the language, then that power, in a sense, would be more warranted than it is.
Mm-hmm.
My concern is that it claims to be unbiased and descriptive, when in fact, in many cases, it is prescriptive. And it's prescriptive in the sense, the very instance we spoke about before, that is inciting men as the leading authorities, that's a kind of prescription about where linguistic meaning lies.
Right. Well, now, let's come to the thorny issue of political correctness. You have been accused, John Walensky, of writing a sort of PC critique and manual about the Oxford English Dictionary. I'm a sensitive guy of the 90s, and I'm going to take that mentality and apply it to our understanding of this cultural institution. Will you respond to that criticism?
Well, in a sense, I think it's fair enough. I mean, I think I am involved in a political correction of the dictionary. I think there has been a misrepresentation of the language along what I would call political lines, and we've used the example of class and gender so far in our discussion. Mm-hmm. So I think that's fair enough. On the other hand, what I'm arguing here for is not a kind of correction that is somehow based on simply politeness, on simply a compensation. It's based on a correction of that the dictionary warrants in terms of its own aims, its own intent to be descriptive of the language. So if you've left out a group of people, if in India, for example, there are more English-speaking writers than there are in England, then it's not political correctness to suggest that they should be included in the dictionary. It's part of the intent of the dictionary.
Well, what happens to the already complex process of understanding the meaning of meaning and putting words into the dictionary? You multiply the work of the editors, 10, 50, 100-fold?
No, not at all. I understand the limits. No one can sample the entire language, and that sampling, in fact, suggests that it's only going to be a partial process. What I'm asking for is a kind of truth in advertising, a very simple, basic claim.
Yeah. What you're going to do.
More than that, Wayne, to tell us what you're going to do. Uh-huh. Tell us about the limitations of the dictionary. Tell us about how it is you arrive at these citations. And in a sense, then, my book forms another supplement to the dictionary.
Well, now, let me argue with you a little bit further here, John. If you tell us if the truth in advertising line here, doesn't that open the OED up to a sort of anything goes and we can't trust them? They are supposed to be our linguistic authority. If they're not going to play by ground rules that everybody understands, why should I?
Well, but the OED, again, I mean, I don't want to move outside of its own intent. When it gives you the citations that it has used for its sources, it gives you the sources. It tells you where they're from. So it has begun the process. What it hasn't told you is how it's selected them. Uh-huh. What it hasn't told you is that whole process by which it arrives at meanings. So I think that the dictionary itself becomes much more trustworthy if we understand how it's put together. And then it's up to you and me to decide whether I want to follow Shakespeare or the New York Times or newspapers from Bangladesh in terms of where it is that I want to find the meaning in the find meaning in the language.
Fair enough. John, what does the OED have to do with English as an empire in our own times here in the 1990s? That is to say, setting up sort of cultural and economic authority bases that the rest of the world had better follow if it wants to get on.
Well, let's take the current political issue of official English that about 22 states at this point have passed. That is a movement to make English the official language of the United States. And I think what the OED tells us is that is potentially disastrous or at least a negative move in terms of the growth and development of the language, because what the dictionary reveals above all else is the strength and richness that we have gained from other languages. The figures vary, but it's about two-thirds of English comes from what are called loan words, that mm-hmm. is from other languages, borrowings. And that an author, I mean a favorite of many of us, is Geoffrey Chaucer, and his great contributions came from his translation of French
sure.
and Latin.
Yeah.
So that whole sense of having a linguistically diverse and rich environment suggests that languages thrive.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? We look back at Chaucer as one of our own icons, and yet paradoxically we use him, in the Crusade to exclude?
As part of the canon.
Exactly.
Whereas he was greatly enriched, and his poetry and his language generally came out of a sense of exchange with other languages.
Well, is it fair to come back, John Walensky, to the issue of what gets included, what gets excluded? Is it fair to criticize the OED, given the insights, the hindsight that you have now, to look back at the original editors and say, no, you made a mistake, you weren't as inclusive as you should have been?
No, I mean, that would be too easy on my part, and I don't think it's fair either. So that political correctness accusation I would stand back from and disavow. My concern is that the dictionary is going to continue to develop, and it's going to take some lessons from the past, that this is a different world, and the whole sense of English as a world language becomes a new responsibility that the Victorians didn't have.
John, give me a concrete sense of inclusion and exclusion when we talk about the OED and an ugly word like anti-Semitism, or is that two words?
No, it's one word. Uh-huh. But the example I did look at in the book was the definition of Jew. I mean, again, it's that harmless sense of just giving a definition. But when you use citations, and many of the distinguished authors are cited in their use of the word Jew, what you get is a litany of anti-Semitic remarks from some of our favorites, authors including James Joyce, D.H. Lawrence, William Faulkner. And what I found interesting in the citations is that if it's in a novel, for example...
It's okay somehow.
Well, that's right. It's an author. It's a character speaking, right. And the anti-Semitism reflects the character, not the author. But the OED is more comprehensive than that. It also cites an author's letters. So what do you do when a personal letter is cited? And James Joyce provides a lovely example in which two citations, one anti-Semitic remark in a letter and one in Ulysses, you have to think twice about it. And my challenge to the dictionary and to editors was to think about how the citations themselves, even though the definition is neutral, and it's interesting with the definition for Jew, they changed it because originally it referred to race, for example, and they removed that reference in the definition. But the citations, after this very neutral definition, the citations can be very discouraging, can be very anti-Semitic.
Well, we've just been through an episode in the United States where the so-called N-word has played an enormous role in our understanding of, oh my goodness, where do we begin with the OJ-itis thing here? You know, the way the courts work, the way the police departments work, the way people just generally in the culture understand the whole thorny issue of race and racism.
And the N-word is in the OED and has numerous citations. Mm-hmm. And the distinction that's made, and again, the editors approached it with some delicacy, was it depended on who used the N-word, that is, whether an African-American or non-African-American used the word. Mm-hmm. But the citations, and I think that's an interesting aspect of the dictionary, are provide an eye-opener in terms of who has used it.
Well, here we're back. Here we're back to fluidity, and we're back to subjectivity, and those are just two things that we cannot avoid when we try to figure out the meaning of meaning.
Well, I hope that's the lesson that people take, and that is that there is no authoritative source or single source of meaning in the language, and that it's something that all of us are participating in and have some responsibility for, and that we can't simply rely on the dictionary as the last resort.
John Walensky is the author of Empire of Words, The Reign of the OED. Empire of Words is available from Princeton University Press. John Walensky directs the Center for the Study of Curriculum and Instruction at the University of British Columbia. His books include The Well-Tempered Tongue and The New Literacy. You're listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Audio tapes of this discussion are available for $10 postpaid. Our address is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. When you write, please ask for program number 798. That's $10, program number 798. Our address again is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. If you want more information about the National Humanities Center, write to us or call during business hours Eastern Time. Our phone number is area code 919-549-0661. That's area code 919-549-0661. Next week on Soundings, another segment in our continuing series on the idea of a civil society. Listen for conversations featuring Ekaterina Nikova of the Institute for Balkan Studies at the Bulgarian Academy of Sciences, Harvard professor Robert Putnam, and Irish statesman, writer, and diplomat Connor Cruz O'Brien. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.